Call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is February the 10th. We have present Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman. Cronk is at another meeting. Senator Cronk and Senator Olson is excused. Hope everyone is still flying high like the Eagles are this morning. Today we have a presentation by the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation from the Department of Revenue. Joining us today is the president of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, Frank Richards. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Frank Richards, the president of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And with the chair's approval, I'd like to bring up a colleague, Matt Kissinger, the head of our commercial and venture development.
Please.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Matt Kissinger, venture development for AGDC.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, thank you again to the committee for having us to be able to come forward and present again our activities on advancement of the Alaska LNG project and how recent activities and interests have, again, propelled us moving this project forward. We'll also talk about some of the work that we did over the interim with the work by Wood Mackenzie, but then also talk about where we are progressing in terms of an in-state pipeline and ultimately the entire Alaska LNG project. But I thought it might be helpful for the public that's listening in to first understand who AGDC is. It is a corporation of the state of Alaska that was created by the state legislature in 2013 with House Bill 9, and then additional responsibilities granted under Senate Bill 138. So we represent the state of Alaska in trying to maximize the North Slope natural gas resources in development of infrastructure to deliver those resources to Alaskans and ultimately to the international markets. So we are currently the 100% owner of the Alaska LNG project and then transitioning that to private ownership with qualified developers. So the Alaska LNG project in total, just a reminder that this is a mega project that represents the opportunity for Alaska to finally commercialize the natural gas resources that exist on the North Slope of Alaska. It was designed with the premise that the initial gas would be delivered from both Point Thompson Unit, or PBU, and the Prudhoe Bay Unit, PBU, where there's 40 trillion cubic feet of known gas reserves, specifically in Prudhoe Bay. About 8.5 billion standard cubic feet of gas is developed on a daily basis and then recycled, compressed, and pushed back down into the reservoir. Across the North Slope, 122 trillion cubic feet of proved producing reserves in Alaska. And so this comes from the Energy Information Agency that takes account for known resources as provided by the producers across the region. And then there are new entrants looking for oil and gas, and in particular developer called Great Bear Pantheon that has worked with us on a gas supply precedent agreement. The project will consist of what we call an Arctic carbon capture plant, which is a treatment plant located in the Prudhoe Bay unit, where the gas streams will be combined from Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, and the constituents of carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide will be removed. Almost 7 million tons of carbon dioxide will be removed from the gas stream and then pushed back down into the geologic formations for sequestration and potentially the 45Q tax credits. That produces LNG-quality gas that is then enters into the pipeline, which is 807 miles running from Prudhoe Bay through the state of Alaska with offtakes along the way to communities and natural resource developments that may desire to have gas. And then we'll ultimately end in Nikiski, where the liquefaction facility will be built. And the liquefaction facility is where the natural gas moves from a gaseous state, it's compressed, it's refrigerated, and it becomes a liquid. Then it becomes more of a commodity to be easily moved to the Asian markets. So that's where the 20 million ton per year liquefaction facility will be located, with a marine facility directly in Cook Inlet, adjacent to the former Kenai LNG plant. So this is the entire project, currently proposed at about $44 billion. And again, those cost estimates were in early 2024. So we know that there have been impacts to the costs with inflation. And then we are certainly considering the impacts of potential new tariffs that may come into play.
What are those new tariffs?
Mr. Chairman, reading the news, it sounded like the President was considering 25% tariff on steel imports for construction. So this is late-breaking news. We need to understand what that means ultimately to the project. But we looked at this previously and went through what was known as a best country sourcing review, looking at what those tariffs mean for various countries across the globe in terms of what the U.S. would impart on construction, but also raw materials, and looked at how to best assemble that so that we are able to provide the lowest cost of the construction of those materials that will be built even offshore and brought to Alaska.
Well, you're talking about the actual pipeline itself. Are you going to be addressing the cost of infrastructure and what the infrastructure might be needed to make this pipeline operable?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we'll be glad to talk about that. And in the very next slide, specifically looking at the cost of the pipeline initially for in-state needs, what we call phase one. So I just wanted to identify, this is the overall project. This is the ultimate goal that was granted or given to us in the direction by the legislature in Senate Bill 138. Advance forward on developing an LNG project to be able to commercialize those assets for Alaskans, being able to provide gas to Alaskans, and then ultimately for export and the benefit of that export to the state of Alaska. Sorry, there we go. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. So now switching topics to what we are calling phase one, and this is really just the initial phase of the Alaska LNG project, where we saw that there is a need potentially for gas to be able to be provided to Alaskans, specifically in South Central and in interior Alaska, and looked at the option of potentially moving forward with a phasing of the project to pre-build the pipeline portion of the project. So this represents a 42-inch diameter pipeline from the North Slope of Alaska to South Central Alaska with a total cost of about $10.8 billion. So this is really just the pipe. It's not, does not include compressor stations. There will be a head station or pressure station at the top that will be provided by the providers of the gas. And then ultimately, it will have offtakes available for Alaskan communities and the resource developers that want to have gas coming off the project. And then the second phase of the project is what we considered to be the completion of the project, which would be the construction of the gas treatment plant on the North Slope, the liquefaction facility, and the extension of the pipeline across Cook Inlet, and the building of the compressor stations to make sure that we're able to flow the gas necessary for the full 20 million tons per year. But we're looking to do this really as the offset to try and deliver gas to Alaskans at the earliest possible date and at a cost that is competitive to the price of imported LNG.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know this isn't the point of the presentation, but just so I'm clear, this $11 billion number, which may or may not go up with steel tariffs, you said that doesn't include gas treatment plants. So the gas gets to the end of the line, it's still got hydrogen sulfide CO2 gas liquids in it, and that's the customer's job to get those out? Or how does that work? I'm sorry.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I was going to address that in a later slide, but I'll be happy to right now. And that's where earlier this in 2024, we actually signed what's known as a gas sales precedent agreement with a new developer called Great Bear Pantheon. So this is for an exploration project that they have going on about 20 miles south of Prudhoe Bay. The output of their initial wells and their flow tests show that they have considerable amount of gas and the gas constituents are significantly different, meaning it has very little carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide, in a range of 0.5%. So that means that for consumption within Alaska, the gas could directly come off of that prospect, flow into the pipeline, and directly into Alaskans' homes and power generation and be consumed. That's, as I said, a prospect. So we needed to back that up, making sure that we had availability of gas should that not come to fruition. And so we've looked at the Point Thompson gas unit. The Point Thompson gas would require another 62 miles of pipeline from Point Thompson to Prudhoe Bay. But the Point Thompson gas has a much lower CO2 than Prudhoe Bay. So the concept is to use Point Thompson gas as a backup. It will not require the full build-out of a major gas conditioning facility to be able to meet the pipeline quality gas necessary for delivery in Alaska.
I'd like to acknowledge that Senator Giesel has been here since the beginning of the presentation. Senator Keel, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, looking at phase one, how much of that capacity of the project would be pre-sold and then utilized? And then I'd like to have you explain to me a little bit. Do you go to a state bank? How do you finance this thing?
Mr. Richards.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the capacity on the pipeline as designed for the full flow is about 3 billion standard cubic feet a day. The in-state needs that we looked at range from approximately 180 million to 200 million standard cubic feet a day. So it is a small percentage of the full capacity of the project. The reason why we went with the full 42-inch is because those are the permits and the designs that we have in place, and we went through and received the authorization from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to construct. If we looked at changing the diameter of the project, we'd have to reopen the environmental process, which could take some time, and therefore add additional cost. So we went with the full design, knowing full well that the off-takers will be within Alaska. Again, the design was to provide gas to Alaskan utilities and Alaska industry that had the desire. So the next phase of this is to go forward with front-end engineering and design, and that's really to bring up to date the cost estimate, currently estimated at $10.8 billion, and be able that will then be used to identify what the overall cost would be for the off-takers. Those contracts are not occurring today. Those contracts are going to occur in the future, and will be the opportunity for those off-takers to then have a clear understanding of what the overall cost is and how they will, if they are comfortable signing those contracts. So in regards to the financing, I'll ask Matt to give an update.
Yep. Matt, please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. For the record, Matt Kissinger, through the chair, Senator Stedman. The way we will finance it will be through a traditional project finance structure. We're looking at around 70% debt, 30% equity. The debt would be underpinned by the federal loan guarantees. That's something that we're working on right now, or will be working on shortly with the incoming administration's Department of Energy. The remaining will be funded by the equity investors, and those, as Frank mentions, will be backed by the long-term offtake commitments of the ultimate buyers of the gas. And this is one reason why we want to keep that line of sight to phase two and beyond. As you do phase one, and we'll talk about this shortly, the cost of that gas to Alaskans is less than imported LNG. It's around the cost of right now the newest contracts out of Cook Inlet, but in no way is it where we want to be cost-wise. Ultimately, we can get down to rates that are about half of what we were paying.
Senator Stedman.
So I need some help with that. What does the, because we haven't looked at this in detail much over the last few years, so help me with the guarantee by the federal government. Is that against default, or is it against late debt service payments? What are they actually guaranteeing to the bondholder?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, they would be guaranteeing against default of the buyers, that's right, or of the transporters.
Okay.
Senator Stedman?
And if you have a 10% subscription or whatever number it is off the $3 billion, the capacity of the pipe, how much volume do you have to move down there to pay that debt service, just to break even, if you have a 70% debt?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, as you'll see when we go through the WoodMac report part of this presentation, the cost to deliver the in-state volumes of gas are somewhere in the $12 to $13 per MMBTU range. That includes the full service of the debt, but also includes the return on equity for the investors, as well as the operating costs.
Senator Stedman.
So if we never get to phase two, we don't have to worry about it, it'll be fine. Is what you're telling me.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that's depends on the definition of fine, but it would be less than importing LNG.
Okay, let me clarify the question. So if you don't get to phase two, phase one ends up standalone. Assuming Pantheon, you know, would give the comfort level of their ability to produce, to issue the debt in the debt market. Exxon's sitting at Point Thompson, I'm sure it could fulfill that issue. Then this would be a viable standalone project, is what you're telling me?
Through the
Without
chair.
Without phase two.
Mr. Kissinger.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, correct. This is sustainable as just phase one.
Senator Stedman.
And there's no issues, unless you're going to get into them and help us with it, there's no issues with availability, as the chairman had mentioned, with physical infrastructure, the port, all that stuff. How is that addressed, or should we be concerned with it at all?
Mr. Richards.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, again, the infrastructure, if I believe what you're asking about, is the physical infrastructure necessary to construct this project. So we have the Dalton Highway, we have the bridges, we have the Parks Highway, they have the Alaska Railroad, and we have the ports in Alaska that would receive the incoming pipe shipments. For instance, Seward. Seward will be potentially the entry point for the pipe to be delivered to Alaska, put onto the railroad, and then transported along the railroad route, which parallels a vast segment of the southern portion of the project, and delivery points into Fairbanks, where it will then be trucked from Fairbanks up along the Dalton Highway. If you recall, many years ago, we looked at where there might be pinch points within the infrastructure for building of this pipeline, and we talked about the bridge updates to be able to handle the module loads and the heavy loads that would be constructed with this. And over the course of the last 10 to 15 years, a lot of those bridges have been retrofitted to be able to handle those loads necessary for not only the module construction within Alaska, but also the pipe load. So from our estimation is that the infrastructure is in good condition to be able to support the construction of this project.
So you're saying that there would be no need for upgrades to the existing infrastructure to even transport the pipe for this project, as well as the docks and in Seward, I assume.
Mr.
There are no additional anticipated expenditures to for those upgrades.
Mr. Chairman, we've been in consultation with the Alaska Railroad, with the Department of Transportation, about what is going to be needed for this. We understand that there is port development ongoing that was planned beyond this project for needs within Seward, but that will just add additional positive benefit that they have good infrastructure ready to receive and then move the pipe along the corridor, the transportation corridors that we have already in existence.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I failed to connect a wire. You were talking about tariffs and steel from what countries, but then you mentioned a federal loan guarantee. Doesn't a federal loan guarantee subject the project to Buy America, Build America rules? Don't you have to get U.S. steel?
Go ahead.
Mr. Kissinger.
For the record, Matt Kissinger, through the chair, Senator Keel. The regulations, actually, for those loan guarantees are under development. So these loan guarantees are in statute. They were originally in statute from the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act of 2004. These were later amended during the bilateral infrastructure law when that went into place. That allowed them to be applied to the LNG export project. But as of yet, the actual regulations for these have not been developed. And that's what we'll be working with the Department of Energy on. So there's no answer to that question on what those requirements will be with regards to Buy America.
Senator Keel.
Just out of curiosity, does that raise your steel price more than 25% if you do have to get American steel?
Through the Richards. Chair, Senator Keel, we can't place a number on it right now. Again, my understanding of the federal procurement or granting authorizations is that if you are granted money to construct, then you have Buy America clause. In this case, it is really, and Matt will correct me if I'm wrong, but this is in the debt structure, and where the federal government would fall into that debt structure to be able to essentially underpin and identify if there is a default that the federal government, the full faith of the federal government, can be used to be able to cover any default. I'm not aware that within the Department of Energy's regulations that there is that Buy America clause for loan guarantees. But that's something we will look.
Thank you, Senator Keel. During the, when Governor Murkowski was here, a lot of time was spent on the labor force that was needed. It was presented to the legislature that we're woefully in need of trained individuals, if we could find them. And I'm wondering at this stage, what's the prognosis of that being a major problem in the construction of the pipeline?
Mr. Chairman, again, depending on the time the pipeline is to be constructed, it may be an issue. Talking with the heads of the labor unions last week, they clearly identified that they have a workforce that they can pull from to be able to have readily available workers on this project. The goal is to maximize the workforce from Alaskans. However, it may require, as we're seeing, that there'll be outside workforce that will need to come in as well. So that's something we read most recently in Legislative Digest, but also in the Trends report showing that Alaska has been importing workers to be able to address our construction needs.
Senator Stedman.
Some of us have sat here, Mr. Chairman, for many, many presentations on the gas line. We've never sat here and heard that the Alaska workforce can build a gas line. The workforce, we've been told, is going to come from all over America. It may come from Alberta. They're going to have to muster the crew from basically Mexico North. When we look at the historical conversations on producing the steel, as I recall, and maybe the steel industry's changed since the Murkowski administration, they were talking about somewhere around 1 year worth of the steel production of the quality of steel they needed to build a gas line. To get the steel, you have to get in line with the steel suppliers and get queued up and get the steel delivered to land the steel in Alaska, where they were looking at substantial port improvements. We have not got into the road feasibility or condition, but from this year yet. But from what we're preliminary hearing from the industry, there are substantial challenges with the Dalton Highway, with the amount of construction underway as we speak, with Pica and Willow. And this is significantly bigger. Then there was a lot of conversation of rebuilding all the infrastructure that's going to get heavily used in the construction of this project as an additional cost that the state had to look at and incurring. So all these things are already in the record. They haven't, from what I can see, vanished, and they need to be addressed as we move forward. I think we all want a gas line. What we don't want is an upside-down project. So there is those concerns. It'll be interesting to see when we dig into the financing of phase one how difficult it would be to finance a $10 billion, or if it comes in at 10, if it comes in at 15 or some whatever number it is, with such a low subscription rate, and how that works. We'll have to dig into that further. Somebody's got to bear the cost of the debt service, and it won't be the federal government on default. That'll bring some comfort range in, but those along the line of utilizing it. And the only way you can, Mr. Chairman, and I can see to protect some of the consumers is you end up having to increase your equity position. In other words, the state being forced to come in and basically bail out the project if it goes upside down. So I'm not along the rail belt, my constituents, but they would still be impacted of all the cash call to the state. So we, I think we need to take a look at some of these past issues, update them, and Mr. Chairman, if I recall, there's a whole set of discussions on property tax and royalties in kind, so on and so forth, that need to be worked on. A $10 billion project is a staggering size of a project, and that doesn't include the other 30-some billion. And if this whole project ends up at $60 billion or some number. So there's some concern that the presentations flow in with some of the past data that we've worked on at this committee. And we're talking years, not two or three hearings, literally years that we've spent at this table. And some of us have been here through all of it. Some of us will be new. But this is a very, very large project, and, you know, we all want it to go forward, but we don't want it upside down.
Mr. Richards, do you have any comments upon Senator Stedman's statement?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I mean, you were very accurate in terms of representation of the information flow that has come to the committee. I would say that the only way a project is going to go forward is if it is going to be economic and you can have the underpinning of the finances to be able to do that, or the project will not take final investment decision. So our efforts right now are to update the cost estimates, the execution plan, to be able to deliver that information to a private sector entities to make the decision on whether or not they want to take a final investment decision to execute the project. If, for instance, the project goes from $10 billion to $15 billion, what does that do to the offtake cost for Alaskans? It likely puts us out of the competition for imported LNG. We have to see that. We have to go through that updated cost estimate to look at what is that new price of steel, what is the cost of the import tariffs to the project so that we can then make an informed decision. And that's what we're talking about with the next phase, the next step of this project, which is front-end engineering and design. That's the goal that we had put forward in our discussions with the legislature last year, is to go forward to see through a FEED specifically for phase one. Because we've been working to entice private sector entities to come into the project initially with a goal of $150 million for the design FEED update for the entire project. And this subset, this phase one, was really about what Alaskan can do for Alaska's needs and ultimately for this to be able to make sure that we have energy to heat our homes and provide for the power. The senator talked about, again, the impact of steel manufacturing. And there has been some changes in the manufacturing business since we first started talking about this. And the goal or the intent initially was that it would be imported steel. But now there are manufacturers in the United States that are rolling 42 and 48-inch pipe. So that pipe could be used and will be used on this project. So we feel that there is American manufacturing capabilities to be able to meet the overall delivery of the pipe. And again, we do have, through our Department of Natural Resource pipeline right-of-way lease, the requirement for a highway use agreement with the Department of Transportation. So that's ongoing discussions with DOT about how we're going to interact with the existing traffic patterns and existing construction that is planned for along the pipeline corridor. So my answer is we are still working. We're still trying to understand the impacts and still trying to address some of the major concerns that Senator Stebbins brought to the table.
Thank you. Please proceed with your presentation.
Last year, Mr. Chairman, the legislature provided us intent language that's specifically around this Phase 1 project, and that was that we go forward and have an independent third-party analysis done to look at the impacts of the project on Alaska utilities, businesses, and homeowners. And then we compared that to the potential cost of imported LNG, and then ultimately to identify what was going to be the economic value to the state of Alaska. So it was that intent language that we went forward, and we actually hired a firm called Wood Mackenzie to complete the independent third-party analysis of the Alaska LNG Phase 1 pipeline. And the outcome, in general sense, is that it showed a positive economic value to the state of Alaska. So, Mr. Chairman, I thought we would do a quick overview of the Wood Mackenzie report. I know that we provided that to every legislator and new legislators to be able to have at their disposal. But this was, again, the independent third party. The key findings coming out that the Phase 1 pipeline couldn't match or beat the cost of import LNG, and that the pipeline would create new jobs and economic activity within Alaska with a very positive economic outcome. So Phase 1 ultimately, though, also sets the stage for successful projects development for the entire Alaska LNG project. So those other components ultimately leading to export. So in brief, the cost stack that Wood Mackenzie developed on the left-hand side represents, from their estimations, what the cost of LNG imports would range from. And they range from $10.21 to $13.72 per million BTU based on real 2024 dollars. What Wood Mackenzie was not able to include in their calculation was what they describe as the onshore reception cost. This is the cost of building a jetty, the offtake berths, the cryogenic pipes, and storage facility. So that's an additional cost that would be added on top of the $10.20 to $13.72. And then on the right-hand side is their comparison of various cases in terms of baseload rates versus the Wood Mackenzie case versus additional industrial demand and then ultimately the Alaska LNG project. So you can see a stair-stepped reduction in the price of gas that would be delivered to Alaskans as Wood Mackenzie had envisioned. So their case, what they call the WM case, represented about, on a 40-year average, about 180 million standard cubic feet a day that would factor in the goals of Alaska utilities to migrate to some renewables, so a reduction in consumption on existing utilities, but seeing a potential demand from existing industrial demand that would offset that. And they used 180 million standard cubic feet a day and came up with a cost delivered to the distribution system of $11.20. So that showed within the range of the imported LNG that it was with matching or lower than the cost of import LNG. And then further analysis, they looked at the cost of potentially a new greenfield ammonia plant or a restart of an existing ammonia plant, a mine development, and said with additional demand, that would, again, lower the cost of gas for Alaskans down to that $9 or $8.97. And then ultimately, with the full build-out of Alaska LNG and the full capacity of the pipeline being utilized, it brings the cost of gas down to that $2.23. So the goal or the outcome here is that additional gas flowing down the pipe means a reduction in the cost that Alaskans would have to pay in their energy bills.
So if you're looking at this slide, it's really interesting. It would seem to me that at some stage, if you look at the Alaska LNG price of $2.23, and we're potentially looking at imports at $13.72, it would seem to me that Alaskans would be more than willing to pay $5 to $6 instead of the imports of $13.72. So why has that been looked at as an alternative, even though the ultimate savings could be as low as $2.23? Where would we be at $5 to $6 in the construction of the project for the long term? Because I'm sure Alaskans would be more than willing to pay the $5 to $6.
Yeah. For the record, Matt Kissinger. Chairman, so you can think of each of these as a blend of our residential, commercial kind of existing base demand and layers of added industrial demand, which brings our local cost down to that eventually $2 to $3 range. So if you're thinking about the $5 to $6 range, just off the top of our head, that would be something like two trains of our three-train LNG project, or maybe one train of LNG plus some ammonia plus data centers. But either way, the way to bring the local price down, and this is how WoodMac ran these different cases, is just layering on this different industrial demand. So that's really how you would get your local rates from the $13 down to that $5 to $6 range, if that answers your question.
No. Senator Stedman.
So do you perceive forward contracts for takeoff from these potential customers to get that price down to the consumer in Anchorage? Or is the consumer in Anchorage going to take all the risk of this going forward and data centers coming in and the ammonia plant firing back up and all those other needs?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the way it would work would be a common system used in a lot of industrial areas where you have differential rates. So you would have a differential rate for the industrial payers, basically trying to supply gas to them at their threshold, at their startup threshold rate. And each time you do this, that would have a dilution effect on the amount that local rate payers are paying. The alternative being that either, high cost of the Cook Inlet gas, where we are right now, or the imported or a blend of the two with imported LNG. So that's the starting point. We start off lower than that with phase one of the pipeline, and then as you build on industrial demand through differential rates, you dilute that in-state cost of gas as well.
Senator Stedman.
No, I understand that, if you have an 8% subscription or whatever number you're going to end up with when you start, you have a lot of excess capacity, you bring in additional load. The question is, before that, when you put everybody gets on the hook, everybody meaning the Alaska consumers, particularly in the rail belt, get on the hook. They don't know if the LNG, or not the LNG plant, but the ammonia plant's going to come on, or a server center, which basically wants, they're a low-cost energy needed entity along with the ammonia plant. Neither one of them could use high cost energy and compete. So when you put the financial package together to move forward to build it, and once it starts, game's over. The project's going to get done no matter what it costs. How does that, what kind of risk exposure are the Alaska residents and rail belt faced if this doesn't materialize and all these other additional industrial users don't come to the table because of costs or some other constraint?
Mr. Kissinger. Mr. Richards.
Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, if you're referring to the cost overrun risk, that's one thing. That would have to be addressed through the negotiations with the developer, and we're talking about that right now. So this is where you have room in the developer's rate of return, and the developer really should be taking on at least the bulk of that cost overrun risk. Beyond that, it's the feed, so this front-end engineering design, that's going to get us really the mitigation of that cost blowout. Once you have, at the end of feed, your cost estimate that you can go out to bid with your engineering, procurement, and construction contractors, then really what you're left with after that is fundamentally the cost overrun risk. That can be mitigated in a number of ways through partial lump sum turnkey contracts as well as through the developer taking a shave on their return, because that really is their remit, is to build this project on cost and on time.
Senator Stedman.
I wasn't referring to the cost overrun risk. That's a whole other risk exposure. It was to the point when you get to the goal on the project, right? The impression I get here with this slide is you're counting on these additional load factors coming after the fact, after the construction's already been triggered and we're underway, either maybe in the beginning or maybe it's completely constructed. So I guess, are you looking at the data centers and the ammonia plant to commit take or no pay contracts before the construction begins? Or I'm struggling with that whole concept of how you build a 42-inch line and only need 10% of it. And we'll have Wood Mac and other consultants explain that to us in detail. How the economics of this is going to work when everything doesn't come out rosy.
Yep. Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So again, let's go back to a previous question that you asked where you said, is it sustainable? I guess is how I answered it, that phase one. So in the worst case scenario, just based on just the, and it's a decreasing demand forecast that Wood Mac used. So actually they start at the current level of demand under the base load rate that you're seeing there, which is, as you see, still lower than importing LNG. That base load is existing demand with a considerable decline over time based on efficiencies and the potential for population decline. So that 1280 is what we see as the high watermark before you account for cost overrun risk, et cetera. But on the basis of our current cost estimate with the considerable amount of contingency we have in that cost estimate, that would be the high water mark. So that doesn't include any additional industrial demand. And, in fact, it does not even include things like converting the refinery there back into natural gas from propane fuel, which I understand that they would like to do. So there's probably some easy industrial demand growth that's not even accounted for in that base load. So, no, as we go forward, we will be looking for those customers. And as we go towards FID, the final investment decision, which will come after we get that front-end engineering design Class 3 cost estimate, we will be trying to line up as many of those customers as possible. But in the worst-case scenario, if you're just left with the baseload demand of local and residential and commercial customers, you'd end up at that $12.80 rate, based on the current modeling.
Senator Stedman.
And then explain, again, I'm not from the rail belt, so sometimes it gets confusing. There's so many utilities, and we have one utility per town where I live and a few things, so they have their energy map looks a lot different. So explain to me how this deals with Cook Inlet. Is this a total displacement of all Cook Inlet gas, or Cook Inlet continues, or How is the potential conversion of the closed down plant up there by Hill Corp to an import plant? How does that all intertwine, or do we just displace the entire Cook Inlet field and their players?
Who wants to field that question?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we used a sculpted kind of return or tariff during those early years, and what that means is that you map the existing contracts out of Cook Inlet and you feather in gas from the pipeline as those contracts expire, but you don't charge an exorbitant rate when you're at the lower amounts, these lower throughputs. Instead, you spread that in the outer years, and that's called sculpting. It's fairly standard for pipeline tariffs in the early years when you're starting up.
Senator Stedman?
No, that's one.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I only had two questions, but I didn't. That one prompted another. So that then assumes that at the end of the current contracts, Cook Inlet is out of gas, or that they just shut off the taps in Cook Inlet and it all comes from the slope?
Senator Kissinger.
Through the chair.
Mr. Kissinger.
Senator Keel, this just assumes that the demand above and beyond the contracted volumes out of Cook Inlet are met through the pipeline. Whether there's other opportunities or not, I can't say.
Senator Keel.
Okay. Thank you. It's just that at the end of the current contracts, it's not that there's no gas left in Cook Inlet. They're talking about importation because there's not quite enough gas in Cook Inlet to re-up the contracts at the levels that are needed. So that's a little interesting. I guess the other question goes to some of the other risks that are built into the WoodMac analysis, one of which of interest to me, if I remember it right, and I apologize, I think it was presented in November or something, was a 90% cut in the property tax. So that's a tax subsidy by the state, the North Slope Borough, the Fairbanks Borough, the Kenai Borough, Anchorage Muni. So if that doesn't happen or if that goes away, at what point do we figure out whose risk that is? And the other, of course, would be the Great Barrier Prospect, where WoodMac assumes $1 no treatment cost gas straight to the burner tip versus Point Thompson, gas that I think does have some treatment cost and may sell for more than a buck. At what point do my nephews in Anchorage know whether they're putting on both a sweater and a hat or it's cheap?
Mr. Richards.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, again, you're accurate in your remembrance of what was presented in November. In the WoodMac report, they also included a sensitivity analysis, so a tornado chart, where they looked at what would be the impact should certain things happen. So as you said, the base case was on a 2 mil property tax as opposed to a 20 mil property tax, an aspirational goal that we have because Alaskans don't like paying Alaskans taxes. So that's going to be a conversation with the Department of Revenue and the boroughs in terms of the taxes for phase one. So again, this is about pipeline build for Alaskans and Alaskan gas for Alaskans. So hopefully there's some consideration there. If we went from the 2 mil property tax rate up to a 20 mil property tax rate, it essentially adds about $2.20 to the cost of the gas. So $2.20, the Alaskans would be paying Alaskans for that. When we looked at the alternative case of going from a Great Bear Pantheon to a Point Thompson gas, then it adds approximately 78 cents to the cost that you see here at 1120. So it would go to 1198. So there are some adders. We wanted to make sure that we had, it wasn't just based on all rosy conditions, but we wanted to make sure that as we didn't have one opportunity to meet the gas, we had to go to the second opportunity. We want to identify what that cost was going to be. So even at 1198 still shows us competitive to the imported LNG.
Mr. Richards, what schedule are you looking at?
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at the Wood Mackenzie report, page 19.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would love to have the conversation with, Mr. Richards about who subsidizes whom within the state, because it's a little more complex than that. But the primary question was, it sounds like we'll know all those things before anybody hits the go button. We'll know whether Great Bear Pantheon is going to produce the gas. None of these things will be question marks that a later tax or later ratepayer has to bear the risk of. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's accurate. And we'll go through a slide here later on in the deck that actually shows what are all of the components necessary to take a final investment decision. Thanks. Not just the cost estimate, but a considerable number of other contracts.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Richards, I was looking at the total LNG import cost range, and then with what was being said earlier in the discussion, does this include, did this somehow assess the cost of the type of facility that's now being discussed on the Kenai? So when it says range of cost rises when incorporating onshore reception, does that somehow capture what's just been announced?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, again, it was an unknown at the time. It was a potential, but again, not knowing which opportunity was going to be taken advantage of, whether it be a new build or meaning a greenfield development as opposed to a brownfield, which is an existing plant and upgrades to it. So that's why they identified there will be a cost, but an unknown amount depending on which option is selected.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. A different line of questioning, if I may.
Please proceed. Yes.
The Wood Mackenzie analysis is financial in nature, but in my background in capital project management, the biggest one I was ever involved with was only $8 billion, and that was a moose of a project. And we had financial analysis, but we also had peer review where we were challenging our presumptions or assumptions. And yes, the earlier discussion about the logistics of bringing the pipe in, or you know, everything from the procurement, the logistics, double joining, making spools, shipping them up the hall, all the processes and challenges from engineering to procurement. Has there been any type of review, like a peer assist, that, as it's sometimes referred to, kind of check the assumptions against the existing design, if we're assuming a certain diameter, something that would look at the kind of the big picture of executing a project like this, not just the financial analysis, but kind of in the weeds, some of the things that experienced project managers and others in procurement, things that they would notice about a project and its assumptions that might help supplement the financial analysis.
Mr. Richards.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, we've done the peer review analysis before for the entire project, and that was optimization work that we actually did with ExxonMobil and BP after they left the project, and then ultimately had that validated by Fluor as an independent third party. For this particular phase one, we haven't done that because we feel the next major effort should be front-end engineering and design, and in that it will be engineering, procurement, and construction contractors who will be looking at the project again from that perspective of seeing the viability and where there are challenges, and ultimately coming up with revisions or modifications to the execution plan, but also the cost estimates. So in addition to that, we are working with an independent developer to come in and bring their expertise and their perspective to the project. So we'll have EPCs, we'll have owners looking at this, and potentially other partners that will want to come in and be able to partner, and they'll bring their expertise to validate.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, quickly again, part of the other outputs of the Wood Mackenzie report was around the jobs that would be created from this, and these two charts really just show the impact between the imported LNG import option versus a pipeline. Specifically a four-time the number of jobs for construction at about 2,271, both direct and indirect jobs, And then for operations, again, another 4.6%, 4.6 times greater jobs during the operational phases as opposed to imported LNG. And then the final outcome was really to look at what was the economic impact of the Alaska LNG Phase 1, so just the pipeline itself compared to imported LNG. And so this stack shows approximately $10.3 billion of positive economic impact for the state of Alaska from the construction operation of the project, or 7 to 10 times larger than import. Next slide.
Senator Stedman.
Just briefly, I mean, this basically would be a bullet line if we were to do just gasify the rail belt.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, it is a pipeline that would deliver gas to Alaskans, similar to what was the former concept of the bullet line, which was when the legislature first created us.
And while we're talking about the bullet line, you're saying that one of the primary reasons that we're still talking about a 42-inch line is that all of the permits that would have to be reissued under a bullet line. The problem I think that we're facing as Alaskans for the last 4 or 5 years is that the 42-inch line seems out of reach. And when does the state or your department say that it is out of reach and we need to go down and reevaluate whether or not to start all over with a bullet line?
Mr. Chairman, again, we did and have looked at what it would take to modify the project for a different size pipeline. And it was around looking at the cost impacts of it, but also looking at the long-term missed opportunities. And so as you recall, I said shifting the pipeline to a smaller diameter would likely reopen the environmental process again, because, again, what we have right now, what is fully permitted, is the Alaska LNG project in total. So that's where we, as our basis and our starting point, for us to be able to advance and move forward to meet Alaska's needs at the earliest possible time, it is to utilize that existing design and those existing permits. Without that, you would likely go back and look at what does Alaska need all by itself, and then look at the future opportunities through additional pipelines or looping of the project to be able to meet those needs. But that's a total another level of effort that we did not take, because our charge was to move forward ultimately for the Alaska LNG project, but initially to be able to look, can we actually execute a pipeline project to meet Alaska's internal needs first? What we're seeing is a tremendous interest that has come back to the Alaska LNG project. As I stated earlier, we've been out marketing this project. We're asking private developers to come in, fund the front-end engineering and design to move forward for the entire project, and ultimately take that to final investment decision and execution. They are coming to the table. Many of you will meet them. We have entered into an exclusivity agreement with Glenfarm as the project developer at this time, and working on definitive agreements to be able to execute and move this project forward. So that's where they are interested in the full 42-inch diameter pipeline and ultimately the export facility.
And you mentioned many of them. We may meet many of them. And Senator Stedman has voiced his interest in having them come to this committee, and I think he's looking at that, and they may come forward to the committee here so we can have a presentation by them. So you want to comment upon that, Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, one of the things I think that the committee should take a look at is the development in Kitimat, B.C. That's a project that's nearing completion, and have conversations with hopefully some representatives from Alberta and Prince Rupert on that project. I think it faced significant cost overruns and difficulties. It seems like every major project has that. That seems to be the norm. I think we'd get a pretty good feel for the significance of that project and the market that they play in the Pacific. Also, I think it'd be beneficial if we could bring in a gas trader from one of the companies and spool the committee up on the gas trading marketplace. And there is interest from Alberta to do that, to come in and talk to the committee about their experiences. We have a lot of correlation, Alaska and Alberta. So that's something that I think we need to look forward, Mr. Chairman, and try to put together just to give us some more background. It doesn't go unnoticed when the large companies exit a project that have substantial capital, and when they come back to the table, that's more of a positive sign. As I recall, when we looked at the last big project several years ago, one of the Alaska firms backed out, one of the big three, because it could be a company-ending event. So this is no little tiny, you know, rebuild a bridge project. This is one of the biggest projects on the planet. And we've been told that it would probably need all the major finance players on the planet to move it forward also. That's historically what we've been told at this table. It would not be a state bank. It's going to need some deep pockets. And there is the money available and people that are interested. There's no doubt about that. But this is a significant project. So hopefully, Mr. Chairman, we can do that with folks from Alberta, either get them online, or we can also ask Mr. Chairman to have our consultant contact him and work with him and prepare a presentation for us so we can get that information to the table.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed, Mr. Richards.
Lastly, Mr. Chairman, on the Wood Mackenzie report, they also did an analysis looking at what would be essentially the savings to Alaskans from pipeline gas as opposed to import LNG. So this adds another $5.7 billion of direct savings to Alaskans, and so it puts the gross value benefit to Alaskans for pipeline phase one at about $16.5 billion. Mr. Chairman, may I proceed?
Please proceed.
All right, quickly, I'll ask Matt to give an update on our progress.
For the record, Matt Kissinger. I'll try and move somewhat quickly as we're running short on time. There's still a lot to go through. But I think because of the history everyone has with this project, and it's almost everyone in Alaska at this point, it's good to go back and talk about the different phases and where they ended up. So this project started as this producer-led project, Exxon, BP, ConocoPhillips, and the state in. The problem with that is it was the wrong source of capital. The upstream investors aren't looking for that midstream risk. They invest in the midstream where it's necessary to manage political risk. But as you'd note, a lot of the major producers don't own midstream infrastructure in North America. And that's the reason. They don't need to mitigate the political risk here. WoodMac really came to that conclusion in 2016 when the producers commissioned a report from them on project competitiveness. And the result of the report was you need to reconfigure the capital for this project. You need to take advantage of project finance, and you need to find the developers who mitigate the risk, take less risk, and have a much lower cost of capital. There was a period of time where we started to follow the developer model, which is really what they're doing in the Gulf of Mexico. They go out to the market, they sell the gas under these firm LNG sales and purchase agreements. That provides credit support. They come back, and they can line up the financing for the projects. The issue that we had was the credibility of the state going out and leading that. And we were told by all the customers, and despite what may be out there in the news occasionally, we have a lot of demand for and a lot of appetite for Alaska LNG in Asia. It's just it is a big project, and it doesn't need to be taken on by someone without the ability to truly take it to fruition. Because of that, we started the developer-led efforts. And really, these efforts can better be described as kind of like alignment first. We broke the project into its constituent parts, the gas treatment up on the North Slope, the pipeline itself, liquefaction, and began to find the proper midstream developers who are focused exactly on that kind of development. And what they bring to the table is they bring a much, first of all, they're nimble and they're more cost-focused than the major producers are, major oil companies are. They can deliver, because of that, a lower cost of service. They do that through their lower capital requirement, but also by managing costs better. And this is what's brought us to today, where we're now bringing Glenfarne to the table. They'll be the quarterback of these developers. But as we go forward, expect that others will also be joining the team with more depth. Any questions?
Senator Stedman.
Thinking back of past testimony, I think it's accurate to say that some of the big producers don't hold a lot of gas lines per se because of their it's a regulated rate of return. They want a higher rate of return. I think that's just the way it is. They do hold some gas lines or oil pipelines, but basically that's a return issue. There is concern on their part on risk mitigation. There's no doubt about that because it affects the value of the hydrocarbon they own or they have leases to. So they want to risk mitigate it. And a lot of times they will build a project and then divest themselves of it to get away from the regulated rate of return. In comes Enbridge, TransCanada, all these other players and gas lines, and they do the gas line thing. So just I thought I'd mention that. Conversation I had with an ex-fellow that ran Exxon, Tillerson. I asked him what and that was after the exit at Alaska gas line project, what, from his perspective, is one of the biggest challenges of moving this gas line forward. He said one of the challenges that Alaska faces, every governor has a different plan. And it's a multiple-year project, and it's colossal in nature. And again, I think it's still, and I keep bringing this up because I think it gets dumbed down the last several years. Alaska couldn't stay on course on one path through multiple governors to get a multi-year project like this moving forward. But when we have a company like Exxon in Alaska, from the testimony of our previous consultants, they're here not for our oil but for our gas. BP was in harvest mode. Conoco was here for our oil. We had that broken down several years ago when we were working on oil taxes. And you know, when a company the size of Exxon and the quality of that company delivering projects and exposure they've had in large projects and in Arctic issues, which I think is on a whole other subject, companies that are familiar with building in the Arctic, is not at the table. It heightens a level of concern and skepticism and why we want to be careful going forward. So those are just some of the, you know, the background that we've dealt with here. And again, some of us have had multiple meetings on this stuff with multiple consultants and companies and pipeline companies and producers. And so this, let's not lose the fact of the colossal nature of what we have in front of us.
Not only multiple meetings, months and months at the table through several governors. Mr. Richards, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, again, through the chair, Senator Stedman, the producers have said to us they want to sell gas at the wellhead, and we are in no way, as has done in the past, try to force them into the project. We're giving them the opportunity. We engage with the producers to keep them apprised of how we're progressing. We introduce the developers that we are talking to and engage with to the producers so that they both can see the reality of each other and the viability of each other. So there's nothing, I would say, to prevent that world-class knowledge and expertise from ever being utilized on this project. But that will be an economic decision and a commercial decision between those two parties. And I would say that they're fully engaged, and we are conversing very, very routinely.
But the problem that I see, Mr. Richards, is that doesn't the people that own the leases have an obligation to the state of Alaska to produce?
Through the chair, I mean, Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding. When the gas line is built.
That does not mean that their position is we're not going to produce. We're just going to wait for somebody to build the line, and then we're going to sell it at the wellhead. So those are two contrary positions.
Mr. Chairman, I would also recognize that the AOGCC gives the mandate to those leaseholders to produce as much oil, too, because it has a higher value. And so for many decades, the gas was a tremendous benefit to producing the oil. And so one of the considerations is, as you take gas from, let's say, Prudhoe Bay, what is going to be the impact to ultimate oil production? So in 2014, when the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission authorized 3.6 billion standard cubic feet a day from Prudhoe Bay alone, they recognized at the time that there was going to be a couple hundred million barrels of potential oil loss at that time. The AOGCC factored that in and said, no, we authorized up to 3.6 billion cubic feet a day, knowing full well that there was still going to be gas that was going to be developed from the field and pressure regulation. So we're 10 years further down the road. So the goal would be that, or the thought would be, with the existing benefits of Hillcorp, that they've produced a lot more oil, and that's been great for the state of Alaska. Ultimately, gas coming off of Prudhoe Bay and from Point Thompson will be, just as Senator Stedman says, the ultimate goal of selling those resources into the market.
I understand all of that. It was good for Exxon and good for Hillcorp. The problem is Alaskans want gas, natural gas, so because we want cheaper energy. You know, we're in a state where we have the highest energy costs in the United States. And if they have the obligation to produce, we need to look at that. And if they're not willing to do that, maybe the governor needs to look at someone that will produce, because people of Alaska want lower costs of energy. Please proceed. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much has been invested in this project since inception?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, rough numbers of over $1 billion between the state of Alaska and the producers, and the payment by the state of Alaska to the producers.
By the state of Alaska, how much?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, if I may, rather than giving you recollection, let me provide you those numbers.
The numbers are $634.9 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think on that quote, I think that does not include TransCanada's $500 million, I think, what we paid them. So $1.1 billion. We're going to go in and double check that on TransCanada, but I think pretty sure that's the correct number. So anybody that ventures to have a concept that Alaska is not interested in moving the gas line forward is missing the point that we have some cost of $1.1 billion. And we'd like a return on our money.
And that does not bring that to today's dollars. That's just actual dollars at the time that those dollars were appropriated. So it's substantially higher if you take inflation into consideration. Senator Merrick. Thank you, Senator Merrick. Mr. Richards.
Okay, quickly. Yeah, just quickly, as we went about finding these developers to join the project, we were selling the attractiveness of the investment. We had the WoodMac report done in 2021, where they came back and looked at the competitiveness of the project and determined that it is competitive against the marginal supplier to Asia, which would be out of the Gulf of Mexico. We can deliver gas considerably at a lower cost of that supply into Asia than you can out of the Gulf of Mexico. The issue with this project has just always been its size. And then as we are offering the equity to these, we're providing them with the these developers with full project control, majority ownership, et cetera. And what we're asking for in exchange is that they take the project and they fund it to development. They carry the state through to a final investment decision, which means that the state's not paying that capital to get there, that $150 million that Frank mentioned before. We also are ensuring that we keep in mind that we have an obligation to provide Alaskans with the opportunity to invest.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I remember the earlier slides right, right now we own whatever there is to own, and we've spent about $1.1 billion to get it. And the notion here is that we're going to split that out 75-25 to a developer. So then our opportunity to invest beyond that is what? If we decide we want more than 25% equity in the project, or that there's some additional cash call, we're going to need to hang on to 25%?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Keel. So this would give us 25% of the overall hold co. The actual investment after FID into the individual segments, so the GTP on the slope, the pipeline, and the LNG facility, that post-FID investment, the state would have the opportunity but not the obligation to invest up to 25% in. That's what we're carving out.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if with 25% ownership of the holding company, the umbrella company, but we decide not to throw in the billions when we get to the $11 billion before, God forbid, any cost overruns, what are the odds? We then own what?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, there will be certain developer economic streams that flow through to that hold co. So by taking this upfront risk that we have, what we call the binary risk, where, you know, if the project doesn't go forward, you would lose that money. You have access to certain cash flows from the project. Think of things we're targeting. Of course, the contracts still have a long way to go with this, but we're targeting things like overcapacity. Most LNG plants in the lower 48 are operating at 20 to 35% overcapacity, and that's where a lot of the developer economics are coming from. And then there's also your pre-commissioning cargoes, and there may be other forms that we push fund revenues from the project companies up into that hold company.
Senator Keel.
I'll hold off. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Stedman.
Just, you know, the other day we had a comment, well, the last couple of days with the new administration trying to work with Japan to get them interested in our Alaska gas again. And I think, if I remember right, the rough quote from their prime ministers, they had looked at Alaska gas, but they had, you know, less expensive alternatives out of the, basically referring to the Middle East suppliers. It wasn't Gulf of Mexico. So the earlier comment about Wood Mackenzie referencing Gulf of Mexico to Japan and Korea, I would take with a grain of salt, listening to the Japanese prime minister the other day with his discussions with Trump. Hopefully they come back and look at the project and be a great anchor tenant, Japan and Korea. That would be exciting. And if the three governments could get together and finance this, we'd actually have a gas line and fully subscribed. So that is yet to be remain, but that is a positive that we shouldn't overlook.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, again, we'd like to just do a quick introduction to Glen Farm, because as you said, they would likely come in front of the committee, but to ask Matt to spend a couple of minutes.
Okay. So if you look at Glen Farm as a company, their mission, they say they want to realize the potential of the world's energy transition. But the way they're going about this is, as countries bring on more renewables, they need that grid stability. And especially in Asia now, as countries are moving away from coal and they're adding renewables, they're increasingly turning to gas for that grid stability. And adding on to this, you have what's really, if you think about the game changer of shale gas in the 2000s, the data center growth is having the same kind of massive impact on the entire energy industry that that had. And natural gas is the fit to fuel that, as most people are realizing. For an example, if you look at Japan's energy plan, Japan had for years and years forecast a decrease in total energy requirement. Their most recent plan reverses this. It's the first time in a long time, entirely driven by the data revolution. Next slide. So as we said, Glen Farm will be here. I think it's better to allow Glen Farm really to speak for themselves and introduce themselves, but this is just to give a flavor that they do have an emerging global presence. They're very heavily invested in Latin America right now. This is where they've been pursuing this kind of grid stability and renewables plan, and it's worked out very well. They import LNG into Colombia, for example, and they send that through their own owned pipelines. It's their own staff working all of these facilities. They have over 800 employees. And through that, they're able to manage their own stability issues for the renewable plants that they have there. Invested in Panama, invested in Chile, and across Latin America, and with a growth in Asia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I'm going to get way out over my skis because this is something I know basically nothing about it. How did AGDC connect with and choose this company? I don't know how this works. Did you put out an RFP on the street and they won a competitive bid? Did Goldman Sachs and Exxon and all the gas companies in the world say these are the ones, nobody better? Did a hurricane drop their house on a witch? How did they come to your door and how are they in front of us now?
Go ahead. Mr. Richards.
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So we did have a process which was really more about the criteria for a qualified candidate to do this. We had a number of people approached that neither had the financial nor the operational expertise. We didn't go out with an RFP because this was many years in talking to every company that we could find directly and trying to bring them in. So I believe that we talked to every company that has the potential of coming in and developing this project. That is credible. Glen Farm in particular, we'd had a number of conversations with them over the years. They were not interested until they saw that we had begun to phase the project. They are not just interested in phase one. I'll allow them to speak to that themselves, but they're very clear. The real prize is the full build-out. But by being able to phase it, you take this $44 billion behemoth of a project and you make it at least slightly more manageable. Still massive, but along the scale of the project that you developed. Exxon, in particular, had provided a new introduction to Glen Farm. I'd say we already knew them, but Exxon reintroduced us at the highest level. That was done last March, and in fact, at CERAWeek, and from there, the relationship has blossomed.
Senator Keel.
And sort of akin to the question about validating price estimates and the like, did we use anybody externally to screen? You said you talked to everybody. Screen those who were interested?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. We worked with Goldman Sachs on this process for the last 2.5 years.
And this was their recommendation?
I would say that Goldman Sachs in the process, they were more focused on bringing in a lot of the financial investors rather than the strategic investors. We already had open conversations with most of the strategic investors when Goldman came in. So they helped manage that process, but I wouldn't say that they're the ones that went out and said, hey, look at them. We had actually already started conversations with all of the developers.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Obviously I'm showing my ignorance. I think of investors as people who bring money and take risk and expect return. What's the difference between a financial investor and a strategic investor? Does one not bring money?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, they both bring money. It's just one only brings money, and that's the financial investor, whereas the other brings you the development background, so the 800 people on their team, the experience in building LNG import, the experience in building and operating pipelines, and power plants across Latin America, the experience in developing their Texas LNG and Magnolia LNG, both of which are in development phase, of course, so they're not completed. But it's all that that makes you more of a strategic partner. You bring in a lot more to the table than just money.
Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Stedman.
Help me with the interface between Glen Farne and Enbridge and how that structure is, and then I noticed that there's nothing in the Arctic here that from Glen Farne or whatever their name is. And we've always been told that there's significant risk adjustments when you go into the Arctic in cost and available to deliver on time and on budget projects. So help me with those 2 points.
Mr. Richards.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, again, what Glen Farne brings to the table, as Matt said, is the quarterbacking role. So in conversations with North American pipeline companies that have that expertise of developing projects, operating and constructing them in the Arctic, that's where the team that would be built would be able to utilize the expertise of those large pipeline companies in addition to Glen Farne as the lead developer. So it's not in any way shape to say they are going to handle every significant component of this project, but they're going to quarterback the development role to be able to bring in other strategic partners that have that expertise to be able to execute effectively and hopefully the most cost efficiently.
Senator Stedman. Thank you. Mr. Richards, please proceed.
Quickly.
Yeah, just quickly. So we have entered into a term sheet. This was press released as the foundation agreements.
Yes.
We are right now negotiating the definitive agreements. Under this structure, Glen Farne have committed to capitalizing and taking the project all the way to FID. So all the resources that this project needs to get to a final investment decision for each of the three sub-projects, they've committed to providing that. In exchange for that, as we said, the 75% of this project that was handed to AGDC from the producers in 2016, we now hand to Glen Farne to carry it forward. So the state really, or AGDC, really stays where we were when we started this process. We're back at our 25%. We have a quarterback taking it forward. It's a more appropriate quarterback than we had before. And then we've committed milestones with Glen Farne. So if they don't achieve certain milestones, they don't get to stay in that role. They don't get to keep the investment. And these milestones are all about driving the project forward and getting through the front-end engineering design work, the $150 million that we talked about, and to a final investment decision.
Senator Stedman?
The $150 million, is it? Where does it come from? And the $50 million that backstop that's been referenced in the governor's budget, how does that interplay? Or do you have future slides on that?
We do have future slides on that, Senator Stedman.
Senator Merrick.
Along that line, Mr. Chairman, I was just curious what risk Glen Farne is taking on if we're backstopping the $50 million.
Mr. Richards.
Through the chair, again, we haven't executed the agreement yet with ADA. That is the process that we're under for the $50 million backstop for phase one. The concept that Matt described here is for the Alaska LNG project in total. So it's $150 million, which includes $50 million for the pipeline feed. The other $100 million is for the front-end engineering and design for the gas treatment and for the liquefaction facility. So all combined is $150 million. We took a belt and suspenders approach here where we're working with the developer, getting their commitment to fund the entire aspect of the project at $150 million. But before this, we entered into this discussion with ADA and previously with the legislature about a $50 million backstop to advance phase one to meet Alaska's needs with a pipeline. So those things are both going in parallel. We're working with ADA on that project finance agreement, but we haven't concluded that yet. Our goal is to be able to have that in place. And then as we execute the project with Glen Farne, they can elect to either use that feed backstop or not. It may be more efficient or proactive for them to be able to execute this project with their partners without that backstop. Why? Because the project finance agreement we have has a very significant positive upside, that if ADA provides this funding for phase one and we ultimately go forward with the full project and the $50 million backstop is never drawn on, ADA retains their funding, but then there is upside provided to ADA for a significant term where they'll be getting cash flow back into ADA for the state.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, how much risk is Glen Farm taking then?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, Glen Farm is willing to take on the entire risk at this time for $150 million. And if we are successful with the pipeline phase one concept, then that would be provided through the backstop. And they would work with us to be able to execute not only the phase one of the pipeline, but also the subsequent phase, which is the development of the compressor stations and the Cook Inlet Crossing to feed into the liquefaction facility.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So do they have any risk in phase one?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, right now we haven't consummated the definitive agreements with either ADA or with Glen Farm.
Senator Merrick. So,
Is that a yes or a no?
It's a no.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Steadman.
We're just the appropriators, but you know, if you negotiate something, make sure the other party has some skin in the game and it's a direct match. It's always beneficial when you come to the table. If you're a community looking for a capital project or if you're trying to build an LNG facility. There is some concern. We've got in the AK LNG fund $252 million sunk costs so far, according to our little chart here. And if we add it all up outside of TransCanada, we're at $634 million. Does any of that get rolled into this project to get a rate of return on it, or is that, are those funds a sunk cost with no return capacity at all?
Through the chair, Senator Sidman, as Matt described earlier, AGDC will hold that 25% in what is known as the holding company, the top company, which we call H-Star Alaska. And that's where the returns that come from those cash flow payments from the subprojects to the holding company will provide a cash stream, but also for that additional LNG development that will essentially represent potentially up to 25 to 30%, those will flow to the TopCo, and that means that revenue will come into H-Star Alaska, 25% of which will come to AGDC for the state of Alaska and the Treasury.
Senator Steadman.
Just a broader question. When, and that, you know, we got lots of slides here, and the time's going to run out probably before we get done. But when is going to be the time, from your perspective, that the legislature should start engaging in some of these discussions, like the property tax going from 20 mils to, you know, 2 mils, royalty issues, if we're taking it in kind or in cash? We have a whole list of issues to go through that historically the legislature spent months trying to work through. And also like to just point out that whatever decisions or involvement that you may have with the legislature, the vast majority of the legislature has no clue what we're talking about because they weren't even here through all those months and months and months of history over the years, particularly in the House. There's a handful in the Senate, and that's going to change here in a couple of years. There's a huge education curve. When does the legislature involvement in some of these decisions, when we should be considering gearing up to deal with that, or do we have no role?
Mr. Richards.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, the legislature has an extremely important role. As we've tried to describe, what we have done or working on in terms of our agreements with developers is to retain the ability for the state of Alaska to make an investment decision, but not the obligation, because you have been steadfast in your wanting to make sure that we don't put the state of Alaska in place of, in jeopardy of major cost to be incurred by AGDC without the state of Alaska legislature making that decision or appropriation. So that's going forward. We have had discussions over the last few years about what is going to be needed to be able to make this move this project forward. Things have accelerated now over the last few months. The concept of phase one pipeline was really a significant impetus for the countries of Asia and Japan and Korea to look at, again, at this investment, because they see that, again, what they believe is one of the major risks on the project is going to be moving forward, and ultimately they see the outcome, which would be LNG. They see that as an economic opportunity for themselves for not only offtake but also potentially investment. So going forward for the legislature, I would say, yes, the conversation is ripe for with the legislature and with the developer and with the administration and with AGDC to look at what are the mechanisms that we need to be able to educate the legislators and the new folks on, whether it be mega project development and what are the risks associated with it, what are the potential opportunities that the state of Alaska needs to consider going forward, and as we move towards a final investment decision, what is the information that the state of Alaska is going to need to be able to make that decision to either take an investment or not, and then have the ability to be able to understand what are the impacts, what are the benefits, what are the risks associated with it. So I welcome the conversation. I'd be happy to work with all the legislators in terms of being able to provide the information, but also look towards the best way to inform folks and bring them up to speed on not only this project, but in the role of mega projects and how that will impact Alaska.
Senator Stedman.
That would be helpful, especially if we had some kind of a summary document of issues that the legislature needs to be informed about, issues that the legislature needs to make decisions on. Right? Because we all want a project. So whoever's listening to this meeting, don't misinterpret the meeting today. We want the gas to market. But we don't want to go bust along the way or have a $60 or $80 billion gas line that, you know, turns out to be the gas line nightmare from hell. Royalties in kind, royalties in cash seem to have been an issue around the table. A real controversial one, along with property tax. Those are some of the big ones. Even if the legislature has no role in some of these points that you may list out, some of it might be beneficial for the legislature to be informed about.
Mr. Richards.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, more than happy to provide that list potential path forward, and welcome the conversations.
When can you provide that list to this committee so we can disseminate it, Mr. Richards?
Mr. Chairman, I will endeavor to do that this week, by the end of this week.
Thank you. Please proceed.
All right, Mr. Chairman, just in the interest of time, I want to make sure that I meet the committee's goal of getting the information, but quickly, we wanted to provide an update on the feed backstop. We've had some of that conversation. Initially, I wanted to talk about the corporate structure that we have put in place with the legislature granting us the ability to create subsidiaries. We were directed by our board to create H-Star Alaska LNG, which is that top holding company with a series of LLCs underneath it, one for each of the main three sub-projects, the Arctic Carbon Capture Gas Treatment, the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline, and the H-Star LNG project. So this is within this structure where all of the $1 billion of worth of effort, the engineering, the permits, the authorization, all of that now resides within H-Star Alaska. So these are the assets that the state of Alaska has paid for. Why do we need the series LLCs and why with the permits? Because when ExxonMobil put this project together, it was an integrated project, meaning it included all three main sub-projects. So that's what the authorization that we applied for and what we were awarded was an integrated project. So we can't separate them out. They're integral to each other, and they're integral to the authorizations that we have. May I?
Please proceed.
All right, so Glen Farm ownership structure. Matt, I'll pass it to you.
So it's kind of a confusing chart, but really this is trying to describe the Glen Farm as quarterback role. So Glen Farm do bring a lot of the credibility that we need for the project and a lot of the skills that we need. But as you point out, I believe Senator Stedman pointed out that they don't have Arctic experience, for example. There's going to be a lot of places where they don't have the depth, and that's where we'll bring in other developers to join with them, and those other developers would bring on the depth. So take a North American pipeline company. A North American pipeline company with some Arctic experience, you could see them coming in along that gas line, LLC, alongside Glen Farm. Glen Farm will have the quarterback role. They'll be leading, but that other company will be able to bring in that depth to actually carry out the project. For the LNG facility, we've been in conversations with a number of different potential investors out of Asia. These investors come with access to deep supply chains and some of the other things that we will need to carry out this project. And so they would also fit in well alongside Glen Farm, but still with Glen Farm being the quarterback.
Please proceed. Senator Stedman.
Just a quick one, thinking back of the past presentations. You know, we've got our royalty gas. It's very valuable. How does that interplay with the 25% construction cost potential investment? You might want to help us with that, and I think that might be something on the list that the legislature might want to look at also.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, what you're referring to is the royalty in kind, royalty in value determination that is to be made by the Department of Natural Resources. So that's a conversation that I think we will provide with the legislature, with the Department of Natural Resources. That would be where the state could get up to 25% of the ownership of the gas through that determination. But that's just gas that would flow down the pipeline. It doesn't necessarily equate to funding of the capital necessary to be a 25% owner of the pipeline.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Quickly, understanding FEED. This is front-end engineering and design. It's really a technical term that's used in the oil and gas industry to essentially mean that you're moving forward to update your designs and your cost estimates, ultimately to get what is known as to a final investment decision. So this is where we are this is the point we're at right now is entering into FEED, not only for the pipeline, but for the other two main sub-projects. So going back to the FEED backstop timeline, based on the intent language and based on the positive outcomes from Wood Mackenzie, we actually had a conversation with the ADA team to see whether or not our project with a backstop would be eligible under ADA's application process. And they said yes. So we applied, and ultimately they brought this to the ADA board, and the ADA board provided resolution that they would entertain the executive director working on a project finance agreement with AGDC to move forward for only on the phase one pipeline FEED. So that was going to be that, not to be include any other phases of the project, such as the additional $100 million. It was only for the pipeline FEED. So that's where we're currently in negotiations with ADA on that finance agreement. And the goal is to be able to put that in place so that we can then move forward with FEED agreements specifically to the pipeline, advancing on the pipeline FEED, ultimately to deliver gas to Alaskans.
Proceed.
This, Mr. Chairman, is really just a pictorial of a success case where we enter into FEED in 2025, be able to complete the FEED in early 26, line up our financing, and be able to make a final investment decision in that 26 time frame, and then execution of a pipeline over the next 4 years with first gas to Alaskans. in and around 2031. But it's all about understanding, getting updated costs, looking at the new impacts of tariffs and trade implications, and understanding whether or not it's an economic project that should take final investment decision.
Please proceed.
So this, Mr. Chairman, is, again, what are the multitude of factors that a company must consider when taking a final investment decision? So not only the Class 3 cost estimate that comes out of FEED, but whether or not you have your regulatory process complete, meaning the permits and authorization, which we do, whether or not you've engaged with an EPC or an engineering, procurement, and construction contractor to construct the pipeline. So those are part of it. At the same time, you need to look at how you're going to finance the project through both equity and debt financing. You also need to make sure that you have gas supply lined up. So gas that would be sold into the project, which will require gas purchase agreements from North Slope operators. And then on the downstream end of the pipe, you need to have gas offtake agreements with the utilities. And then you need to look at throughout that entire package, whether or not there's any credit support that is needed by that utilities, and ultimately you need to have in place and working alongside you the operations and maintenance folks to make sure that you've got a project that can be operated efficiently and effectively to meet the cost that you're moving forward with your contracts. So,
Senator Stedman.
Just as we're getting close, we'll probably finish our slides, Mr. Chairman, thankfully. But when we look at gas in kind or in cash, previously we had BP, Exxon, and Conoco looking at the project. And our royalty gas was mixed in with all their gas. And we had the discussions on if they were going to, you know, they were going to sell our gas or we were going to sell it ourselves and or just take it to cash at the wellhead. So has AGDC had any conversations on the state's gas interest, the royalty interest, on how to deal with that? And
through the chair, Senator Stedman, we have had a number of conversations with the producers. We're always looking, because of the configuration of the project now, we are always looking at North Slope gas sales. And then the question still remains, will DNR take the royalty in kind or will they elect to take royalty in value? The producers have always expressed to us their desire that the state takes it in kind to avoid some of the things that happened on the oil side with respect to TAPS and the valuation methodology. If it's a North Slope arm's length transaction, it's our contention that that could be in value and that would avoid the state the cost and the unnecessary burden of standing up a sales team and trying to place the contracts on that gas, competing with the majors on the sales of those contracts, where they're much better situated with much more depth on their teams.
Senator Stedman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that's just something that we need to be briefed on and looked at. And obviously, TAPS, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, is owned by the players on the North Slope. This pipeline might be owned by who knows? Nobody in the state, possibly.
Mr. Richards, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, again, we talked about gas supplies. The first one, again, we've signed with Great Bear Pantheon a gas sale precedent agreement. The headline news is the gas price that they gave us ranged from essentially nothing up to a dollar, so a maximum of a dollar. And the beauty of this potential source is that it doesn't require any carbon dioxide or CO2 removal, so it can go directly into the pipeline without any additional compression. But we need to make sure we have backup supply. So with that, then, we've been in consultation with the producers in both Prudhoe Bay, Point Thompson, and the satellite fields about the ability to get gas from those fields as a backup to the Great Bear Pantheon supply. Our role of AGDC, so moving forward, executing definitive agreements with the lead party will mean that we have divested or provided them 75% equity stake in H-Star Alaska. Until that time, we are pushing forward for the Alaska LNG development. So that's where we say pre-definitive agreements. The next phase is what we call pre-FID or pre-final investment decision, and that's where, in this case, Glen Farm would take on the role of moving the project forward, but more importantly, funding the development to get to final investment decision. In addition, we're asking that they carry the state's 25% of the equity ownership to final investment decision, because the state, as you've identified, has spent $1 billion to date. And so therefore, those are the assets that we are bringing to the project, and we would like the developer to then carry AGDC up to the point where then the state gets to make a decision on any investment going forward. So that's where we've been careful to give the state the right but not the obligation to invest should it elect to. And so that's a major decision of the legislature. And then post-FID or post-final investment decision is where, again, if the state is involved in any of the sub-projects, then AGDC would be acting as the owner's representative for the state in the overall project. Mr. Chairman, this is a RACI chart, or Responsibility, Accountability, Consulted, and Informed chart. The key point is pre-final definitive agreements, AGDC has the accountability. Pre-FID, that shifts to the lead developer. And then post-final investment decision, the developer has the accountability with those functions in terms of project leadership, capital expenditures, ultimately in terms of the technical and commercial, and AGDC's role would be for representing the state of Alaska in the equity position. And now, Mr. Chairman, over the last few months, and most recently in the last few days, there's been a lot of news articles that have come out. This represents the in-state news headlines in terms of not only the previous administration, but the existing administration's support for the project. We were the only project that received an executive order, and we have uncommon state support from not only our legislature, but three governors, business leaders, the Alaska Native Corporations, as well as leading labor. So if I may, on the next slide, this is where most recently of the last few days, the countries of Japan, Korea, and Taiwan are publicly identifying their desire to have offtake from Alaska LNG to meet their energy needs going forward. And I will say that we are engaged with these countries as well as with their major companies that would be looking to be part of the offtake or equity positions. And so that exposure has ramped up quite considerably, and ultimately they will become in the role, hopefully, as project partners to be able to take on some of that risk factor in developing this project.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
We have a brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Call the meeting back to order. For those listening, the budget is the 2026 budget request that the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation is next, and the bells have rung, and we need more time to to get into their budget, so we're going to be delaying action on the presentation by ADGC till our Wednesday's meeting. But on the 25%, if up to 25%, this is going to be a major decision, and as far as I can see, the only major source of revenue the state of Alaska has is in the permanent fund. And everyone knows that we do not have access to that, and that is with the people, and that would require a constitutional amendment. So people need to keep that in mind as well. And a constitutional amendment requires two-thirds vote by the House and the Senate. So any closing comments for this meeting, Mr. Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, look forward to continuing the conversation on Wednesday. Appreciate the time of the committee.
Okay. With that, the next meeting, that concludes today's meeting. Our next meeting will be tomorrow, Tuesday, February 11th, and we will be hearing from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We stand adjourned.